Welcome to Worlds in Transition, a pod about the people who have taken matters into their own hands, seeking to build more sustainable and regenerative ways of living in different parts of the world.
Gail Faller is a pioneering regenerative farmer at the Faller Farm near Emporia, Kansas, an area often dominated by conventionally tilled fields. Experiencing the problems of land erosion firsthand is what initially drove Gail to experiment with no-till practices in the mid-1980s. After a few years of experimentations and failures, Gail realized that the key to success was about asking the right questions about what the farm and the land needed. He started using cover crops and brought many different animals back to the farm. This led to the rapid recovery of the land, which also served to repair the water cycle, rehydrate the soil, and improve the overall soil fertility. In this conversation, we discuss the benefits and vulnerabilities that can be involved when doing farming differently, and the urgent need for a regional food system that would support the conversion from monoculture landscapes with their heavily tilled and degraded soils to a diversified system that regenerates communities both above and below the ground.
Gail Faller, I'm sitting here with you, and you're in Kansas.
Yes, Avery, Kansas.
And you are a regenerative farmer in Kansas. How is that? How did you become a regenerative farmer in Kansas?
Well, the story probably can't be told in an hour. I've got quite a history behind me, but basically it came down to I began farming in the late 70s and early 80s. I knew the methods we were using were wrong. I absolutely couldn't stand erosion. And I started looking for something different. And we actually switched the farm to no-till in the mid-80s just to try to eliminate erosion off the farm. And we failed miserably. I was young and arrogant and refused to ask for help. And but by the 90s, technology and information and knowledge had kind of caught up, and no-till was starting to work. And so we converted back to no-till in the 90s. And still struggled, still failed at it. We still had huge erosion problems, but at that time we were growing corn and soybeans, and 2/3 of the corn was being chopped for silage. So we had zero carbon in the system at the end of the year. So it's easy to see in hindsight why we were still having huge erosion problems. And so started looking at cover crops. Actually had a friend talk me into planting one field of wheat. That field just blew up. We do not live in wheat country in eastern Kansas. It's not a very easy crop to grow here, unlike their neighbors to the west. But it became my number one crop, and I soon realized it was about the carbon. It wasn't about the specific crop. And so we started increasing our cover crops, increased wheat and other cereals, brought other high grass crops into the rotation. And then in 2012, I lost my crop insurance because of my management of cover crops. And that sent me to the brink of bankruptcy and really led us to where we are today. Of now we're down to 160 acres from 3,200 acres. We've completely eliminated almost all row cropping. We're now doing direct marketing, grass-finished beef, lamb, pork, chicken, eggs. Education is a large part of our farm. We've been running a field school now. This will be our 10th year next year, trying to educate other farmers, and not just other farmers, but agency people, non-agency people, anybody that's interested in regenerative ag.
The first thing I wanted to check with you, when you say no-till, that means that you were spraying the field so you don't had to plow, right?
Yes. But once we eliminated tillage, we actually had to increase our chemical use early on because, you know, one way or the other, you have to kill weeds. And so in the beginning, when we didn't understand the whole system and that we could control weeds with other plants, with cover crops, our chemical increase went, our chemical use went up drastically in the early years of no-till in the mid-90s. And not only was our herbicide use going up, but we were also suddenly starting to need fungicides, insecticides, you know, and a lot of that was because our system was way too simple. Corn-soybean rotation was allowing us to be under attack from multiple angles. You know, it wasn't just weeds anymore that was attacking.
So, and then cover crop, then you stopped with the use of herbicides.
Yeah, as the cover crops and diversity in a rotation started to increase, our need for herbicides started to decrease. Our need for fertilizer or commercial fertilizer started to decrease, and we completely eliminated insecticides and fungicides within a couple of years.
But then you have said your crop insurance, it failed. You couldn't, you said it stopped or in 2012.
They tried to eliminate me. They refused to pay for claims that I had filed in 2012, and they refused because of what they deemed as my mismanagement of terminating cover crops.
Ah. And that's when, did you, after that, you brought in animals on the farm? Is that what you did after that?
We already had brought animals. We'd already brought cattle back into the, onto the farm. It, you know, it doesn't take many cover crops to realize you've got a lot of really good forage out there. And so cattle that had been removed from the farm because of no-till were brought back almost immediately as soon as we started planting cover crops. The chickens and the lambs and the pigs really didn't follow until a year or two after we lost the crop insurance. About, it's going on about the same time, but for different reasons.
So now you don't have this crop insurance anymore, and you're working with a diversified system then instead?
Yes. Yeah, we do all direct marketing. I have zero interest in ever applying for USDA-funded crop insurance again. For the same reason that I had my crop insurance issues, I am not certified organic either, because that's also overseen by USDA, and I refuse to be a part of that.
Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting. But then you had, so you said that you have many different, how does that work? How many different animals and how many animals do you have at the farm and how many hectares?
In the year 2000, I was growing 3,200 acres of Roundup Ready corn and soybeans. And this year we are on a 162-acre farm. We have 16 mama cows, 70 mama ewes, 3 mama pigs, and somewhere around 200 laying hens, and this year we ran about 1,500 broilers.
And those are also all outside, 1,500?
Everything is outside. Everything is grazed, rotated, yes.
And you have a, do you have a market in Kansas you're selling then directly?
Yes, everything that we're producing is sold direct to consumer. We do sell in a couple of restaurants, but almost all of it is direct to consumer.
Okay, so the normal reaction to what you just said would say that, oh, that's not profitable. That wouldn't work.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's not, trust me, we're not rich. We're, you know, without insurance, you know, for example, on our farm this year, the farm we're on now has an 8-acre orchard and garden in it. And we lost all of our fruit production to 3 freezes, and we lost almost all of the garden production to chemical drift from the neighbors. And with no insurance, no risk management, you know, we took a major financial hit this year. So no, it's not easy. And so the farmers that are looking across to me, they have a pretty good argument of why they don't want to change. But I will also tell you that I'm also not jumping through the government's hoops anymore. I am my own boss for the most part. You know, I now get to meet my customers and answer their questions, which it's wrong. I believe it's wrong for a farmer to grow something and not meet the end customer and not be able to look them in the eye and tell them it was grown with integrity and with, you know, with their best interest at heart. And we now get to do that. So, yeah, we are profitable. You know, it was a huge learning curve for us because farmers in the United States are not taught, I think, purposefully, not taught to tell their story, to learn how to market. We're taught how to stick a seed in the ground and take whatever the higher ups want to give us at the end of the year, if anything. And we've not ever been taught to tell our story, to learn how to market or doing those things. And, you know, when I'm selling ground beef for $7 a pound, I literally could not look my customers in the eye for the first few months. I couldn't do it because it was beyond anything that I'd ever done. Now we understand that the high nutrient density of the product we're selling, the environmental you know, our carbon footprint is much, much lighter. It's very green now. You know, we're doing the things our customers are wanting. And I now look them in the eye and give them our price. And I also realize our price is still cheap. And our ground beef is now $8 a pound, and it's still cheap. And it's interesting when you talk about the conventional farmers today, they're all complaining about lack of income, low prices, et cetera. Then I tell them I'm getting $5 for a dozen eggs, and they think I'm robbing my customer. But how are they going to make money if they don't raise their prices?
So then my question would be that you're in Kansas where there's mostly corn and soy and no-till practices, and you did this switch, quite radical switch. How did you, first of all, come to learn about it, and how did your neighbors react?
Well, first of all, so Kansas, yeah, I'm in the eastern third of Kansas, so corn and soybean are king. Actually, soybean is king here. There's a lot of ground that will go 6 or 7 years without seeing anything other than soybeans grown on it. I actually know of a couple of fields that have been 20 plus years with nothing but soybeans growing on them. Western Kansas is mostly wheat. So how did I make my switch? You know, as I told you, I just had this hatred of erosion. So just switching to no-till in and of itself was a huge hurdle. And most of Kansas is still conventionally tilled. A lot of tillage going on all across the state of Kansas. So there was a lot of peer pressure there not to change. But once I saw the no-till system failing for me, I started asking questions. And, you know, I attended some conferences. The most notable was a conference, No-Till on the Plains, which was centered in Salina, Kansas at the time. And at that point, they really, the whole soil health movement, at least in the U.S. and even partially globally, started in Salina at No-Till on the Plains. They brought in speakers from South America that were already doing cover crops. You know, I got to go listen to them, and that's really where I got the knowledge to go. But I think the bigger thing that I got from that conference was getting to go and spend 2 days with other goofballs like myself and getting propped back up after getting beat up for 363 days. You know, I could get enough fuel in the tank to go back home and turn into what I wanted to do. But you know, the peer pressure is by far the most difficult hurdle to overcome in making any kind of change in farming. My neighbors all mostly thought I was idiots at the time, and most of them probably still do.
So they don't see the change then?
A lot of them don't. There are more and more. I do have some neighbors now, you know, planting cover crops and grazing cover crops and doing some regenerative practices. But also, you know, for me personally, you know, the financial struggles that came about with my dealings with USDA and crop insurance, you know, that took me to the brink of bankruptcy. And you know, it made it really easy for all of the conventional farmers to say, well, he went bankrupt because of his cover crops and because of no-till. And, you know, they didn't know or didn't want to know the whole story. So they had their reason that no-till doesn't work or cover crops doesn't work. And that was all they needed.
So this is actually quite new to me. The whole system is also kept in place, that is conventional agriculture, by these crop insurances that are given out by USDA. Is it so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in order to secure an operating line of credit, you have to buy crop insurance. The bank sells the crop insurance. USDA funds it through taxpayer contributions. It's all subsidized, and it's all designed so that the U.S. government can control the food system, you know.
And from the farmer's perspective, it's an insurance that you're sure that you will be paid a certain amount each year.
Yeah, so that's a few pennies profit is better than no profit at all.
And if you have just one crop, then the risks are higher that you will fail as well, right?
Exactly. You know, the risks are higher with one crop. And also, you know, as I saw, as my system become more monoculture in the 80s and 90s, as we simplified the system, we increased our need for chemicals.
And how much chemicals do you use now?
None. The little bit of crop ground we have left is farmed organically. There is no insecticide or vaccines put into any of the livestock ever. We do use the occasional antibiotic when needed, but other than that, no, there is nothing being brought into the system. No commercial fertilizer, nothing.
And the driver was using the land erosion. It wasn't the market asking for it.
No, there really wasn't a market at the time. It was simply my hatred of erosion in the beginning that started us on this journey. But then, you know, as we got into it, the market started to show up. And part of that was about the same time I'd lost my insurance, Lynette was, she wanted some chickens simply because she was sick of grocery store eggs. And so she bought chickens. And the first year we had them, we had two or three people stopped when they saw chickens running in the yard again, which, first of all, what kind of farm doesn't have chickens running in the yard? This is how simplified we'd begun. We weren't even growing any of our own food on the farm anymore. And so we had two or three people stop and ask if they could buy eggs or chickens from us. And from there, you know, 50 chickens that Lynette bought for ourselves, we turned into an enterprise today that is Circle 7. It is a farm that's directly geared at feeding customers. It's sad, and I didn't even realize how ugly our farm had become. You know, when I grew up, we had chickens just for ourselves. We had pigs. We had cattle. We had two large gardens. My grandparents lived on the farm with us. We canned. We grew all of our own. Today, Kansas, which leads the nation with 90% of Kansas is farmable ground. We lead the nation in percentage farmable. We also import 90% of our food. We're raising all this because we're told we have to feed the world, when the truth is we can't even feed our own state. And one in four kids in Kansas is food insecure.
So Kansas is mostly monocrop then, that's going somewhere?
Yeah, corn, soybeans, and wheat. And then a lot of the corn and soy all goes to the large feedlots. There's a little bit of ethanol industry in Kansas, but most of the corn and soy goes to the large feedlots in western Kansas to feed cattle. So we're growing monoculture grain to feed to a ruminant animal that God didn't design to eat grain, so that we can shove unhealthy food into our customers and then wonder why we have viruses running rampant. You know, there's almost no vegetable or fruit production in Kansas or anything like that. It's corn, soy, wheat, and cows.
But there could be, right?
Yeah. Pre-prohibition, Kansas was the number two grape producer in the United States.
And that was what year? Do you know?
That would have been about 80 years ago.
And the people in Kansas, then, are they asking for local food?
Yeah, there is a decent food movement going on in the urban areas in Kansas. It's growing slowly, but it's growing rapidly, just not fast enough for us. It could always be faster, but I think the one of the few positives from the virus this year is that did help kick it in the butt a little bit. So there's obviously now more people asking about where their food's coming from, either from a nutrient density or a health issue, but most of it's just a food security issue right now, because Big Ag, you know, admittedly, even by their own admission, failed in trying to feed the people during the virus. They admitted they couldn't do it. Unfortunately, the local farm-to-table movement can't handle situations like this either. So it's just proved that we need an overhaul of food production and food distribution, not just in the U.S., but probably globally. And, you know, it's just my personal opinion, but I think we need to be looking at regional food systems. You know, we as farmers in Kansas have no business selling wheat to Iraq or to Finland or to Japan or anybody else. You know, the nutrient, even if it's high nutrient density, there still are things that your body needs is grown in your environment. You know, bringing in food from my environment is not totally healthy for you, even if it's high nutrient dense food, plus the carbon footprint. You know, countries need to be feeding themselves. So I think we just need to have regional food systems, and that way we can handle breakdowns like we've had this year. Even a problem with truck gardening or the small food to table movement today is, you know, transportation. You know, that if we're growing all this food in a regenerative manner, but you've got 50 farmers driving into Kansas City every day to deliver 20 pounds of tomatoes or beef, you know, there goes a lot of your good work out the window, and your carbon footprint just went back up. So we've got to find a better way, you know, some kind of a regional distribution system that allows for regenerative farming, higher price markets, and a better distribution system.
But you said that you're quite lonely, but you said that there are quite a few still regenerative farmers in the state of Kansas.
Yeah, there is a vastly growing number of regenerative farmers at all scales, from, you know, a tenth of an acre to thousands of acres. And I think there's another whole layer of farmers that are doing some no-till and some cover crops that if we showed them a market, they would jump on board rapidly. They're looking for that additional income that we've been talking about for 10 years. We need to get those markets established and going, and I think we can really move this rapidly now in Kansas.
Although for you personally, it was maybe the erosion that brought you into it. You think that right now it's the missing market that doesn't enable the change, that hinders the change?
Well, I think dollars speak more volume to most farmers than anything else. And let's face it, you know, we've got to be profitable. At the end of the day, you like it or not, you agree with the economy that we have or not, the bank has to be paid and the bills have to be paid. And so we have to be profitable. You know, the unfortunate thing is right now we've built a system based solely on profit, and it's not looking at the environmental aspect or the social aspect of it. And we've got to find a system that balances all three of those legs on the stool, not just one.
I've heard some farmers say that they still sell their animals to normal slaughterhouses or to the conventional supply chain. That's not an option then for you?
Mm-hmm. It's an option for me. It's just one we choose not to do. Yeah, why would we want to sell our produce through conventional chains and, you know, sell it for wholesale prices? I couldn't stay in business.
Mm. So tell me about you said you have also this kind of educational center there.
Yeah, we started a what we call a field school 9 years ago. The first year, it was simply a cover crop talk about introducing soil health to farmers. It was a two-day workshop, and we wanted it to be intense. We wanted it to be more than just a 101. And Dr. Jill Clapperton, who's a rhizophere ecologist here in the U.S., helped me get it started. And she was adamant that we weren't going to be the typical workshop and hand out donuts and coffee and a barbecue lunch from the cheapest place that we could find. We were going to source local food. At the workshop, we did a one-hour presentation on soil health as it relates to human health. And that was 9 years ago. It was the first time I'd ever heard anybody talk about human health at a farm conference. And from there, the school became a very in-depth look at carbon, water, mineral cycles, energy flow, and how the relationship with them and soil health and human health is all one. And we've had speakers from all over the world. We've had attendees from all over the world. It's become a very in-depth, kind of a train-the-trainer type session now, that looking forward to our 10th year next year.
So let's talk a little bit about that, the soil health and the human health, and how have you experienced that change? Have you seen this change in your soil? What is it that makes that change?
Yeah, we've seen it really rapidly in our soil. Because I was one of the first people in the U.S. to plant cover crops and no-till and some of these things, I got asked to start speaking at some conferences, and the great part about that was I was able to run into other handful of like-minded farmers and a couple of scientists like Jill Clapperton, and I met Gabe Brown, and I became friends really early on. And, you know, there was a couple of conferences where he and Jill and I were sitting at the bar at midnight after the conference was over and just comparing notes, and Gabe and I were seeing similar things on our farms, even though he's in North Dakota and I'm in Kansas. You know, our grain was drying down slower, our crops had darker color to them, and Jill just made the comment, yeah, that's a direct correlation between the healthier soil and the healthier plants. And so then the next question out of our mouths was, well, then the wheat or the corn should have higher protein or more nutrition in it, correct? And she agreed, but there was almost no data at the time to back any of this up. And about the same time, Lynette is at home, and as I told you, she wanted chickens so that we wouldn't have to have grocery store eggs anymore. And so she has went on a quest of her own of studying human health and healthy food and what did that mean. And I would be coming home from these conferences, and, you know, and I met just great people like Dr. Chris Nichols and Christine Jones and then other farmers all over the country, and listening to their sessions at conferences And suddenly the conversations that I was bringing home from these conferences about farming were paralleling the conversations that Lynette was reading online about human health. And so we were able to make that connection. And on a personal level, not only did we see the changes in our plants and our animals, but personally, you know, I lost 30 pounds. I was high cholesterol, high blood pressure. And today, you know, my weight is almost the same as it was when I graduated high school. I'm not on any prescriptions. My cholesterol is in line. I sleep at night. All of those problems that I had 10 or 15 years ago are going away. This is what regenerative ag is regenerating communities, whether it's your gut or the rural communities or whatever. It's regenerating communities. For me, regenerative ag isn't about planting some cover crops. And, you know, it's about regenerating communities above ground, below ground, urban, rural, human, animal, whatever. I pose a question to anybody that comes to our farm on tours or whatever, you know, what keeps you awake at night? Whether they're farmers or consumers or government officials, throw me out one or two of your biggest problems. And they all do. And I say, I can fix that with soil. And I've yet to be trumped yet. There isn't one thing I have found on this planet that we can't fix with soil.
Mm. But how do you fix the soil?
Well, the best way to fix the farm, and it goes back to the book that I go back to the most, was One Straw Revolution by Masanobu Fukuoka from Japan. We humans have to quit conquering. Just step back. So my job is to help speed the process with plants, animals, mimicking the template of nature that grew the deep, rich soils on the Great Plains, you know, hundreds of years ago. I'm just trying to mimic the template that she set forth, and then stay out of the way.
Stay out of the way.
And that's extremely difficult for humans to do, because we want to be in charge. We think we are the managers. You know, farming is about conquering, and, you know, really human behavior is about conquering. And we've got to lose that mentality and learn to become synergistic, or we're going to be removed from the system. It was not an easy road to get here, but I totally believe in it today. And, you know, I think that Mother Nature is looking for a new tenant. I think that's what climate change and the virus are about. She's fed up with who she has running the planet right now, and it's us that need to be on the endangered species list.
But one thing you said, that you have to get rid of the weed. Do you still have to get rid of the weed?
Weeds are, they're all plants are indicators. Weeds are just indicators of what's out of balance in the system. You know, they only grow where they can, and a weed's entire job is to balance the system and extinct itself. So weeds are actually great plants if you take the time to listen to what they're trying to tell you. And that's what I say, you know, my job is to try to help Mother Nature speed the process. You know, part of that is reading weeds. What are they telling me is deficient in this area, and how can I help speed the recovery? And then the weeds will disappear.
Something like that I've heard a long time ago, actually, from indigenous knowledge, is that everything exists in nature for a reason.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm glad you brought up the indigenous, because I think we really need to reach out to these tribes and these people, because we discounted all of this experiential knowledge that they brought with them for generations and centuries, millennia maybe even. And, you know, we discounted them as just being idiot wanderers of the plains or wherever they were from. And they weren't. They were actually doing agriculture at the time. You know, we need to learn from these people and work with these people. And I think we can help speed the process of regeneration with their help.
Does that knowledge still exist in the U.S.?
Some of the knowledge is still here. I'm sure some of it has been lost, but it's just a guess on my part. But I know there is still some of the knowledge is still intact.
You said something about the soil and water cycle. Is there something there that you could still explain to me?
I think it's the whole art of regeneration, or the whole movement of regeneration, hinges on repairing the water cycle, rehydrating the soil. It's as simple as that, is getting water to run in instead of running off. And once we do that, once we can get water to run into the soil, then the soil is healthier, the mineral cycle, photosynthesis, energy flow, all of those things come into line. But it's all simply a matter of getting the water cycle repaired and getting the water running back into the ground.
What happened at your farm when you changed with the water?
In the beginning, we didn't do baseline work, but looking back, you know, and using NRCS data and what my neighboring farms look like today, you know, the water infiltration rates in my area are around a half inch an hour. And, 4 or 5 years ago on our farm, we were up to 1 inch per minute and the second inch in under 2 minutes infiltration rates. Our organic matter had gone from 2% to 5 to 7%. And, the rest of the story is the 160 acres we're on today, we've just relocated to in the last year. So we are back to ground zero with soil health, and we are on a highly degraded farm. And part of our education and research here will be to show how much faster we can do it the second go around with the knowledge that we have gained over the last 20 years and do it with a glass house, so to speak, with all of my neighbors watching.
Did you do that voluntarily, start all over again?
Kinda.
To show that it works?
That was part of the discussion, yes, is because we got a lot of pushback. Our farm was, you know, already very healthy. And so, you know, yeah, but it took you 20 years to get there, blah, blah, blah. Why would I want to do that? And now we're going to start at ground zero and show them how fast it can be done and, you know, and exactly how to do it from step one.
What about, so the water that goes out from your farm, out to ditches, to the flow that flows into rivers, is there a difference there as well in the quality of the water?
On our old farm, on the rare occasion when water did leave, it was clear. But it was a very rare occasion that water left the farm anymore. On our soils that we had really focused on our soil health, the infiltration rate was so fast we could soak in almost all the rainfall we got. That, you know, that includes the rainfall events today that are becoming much more extreme, much more intense. So on the new farm that we just moved to last fall, this degraded 160 acres, we've done the baseline work here. And our first inch of rainfall infiltrates in over 45 minutes. So it's absolutely horrible. And so there's a lot of water leaving this farm. It's dirty water. It's loaded with our soil and, you know, which is our money. So our whole goal is within 5 years to have no water leaving the farm. We do that with seeds, animals, and fixing the biology.
When it's raining that heavily, and animals, isn't that a problem that animals are stepping around there in the mud?
It can be if it's a management issue that we've got areas we can get animals on for the short period for a year or two if we have to protect, you know, them from blowing out an area, and then we will fix those sacrifice areas later. You know, because we're keeping the animals constantly on the move, there's less chance of them doing damage. But yeah, that is a great question and something that's got to be thought through, and there's got to be a plan in place before you bring livestock back onto a farm.
That's quite some stories, and I would love to visit and see it in person. I feel like I just get like 10% of the story when I can't experience it myself.
In person is much better than virtual, I promise you.
Yeah, so, I am sure. Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
And thank you for everything you're doing in Finland, and looking forward to seeing great changes there in the coming years.
You have listened to Worlds in Transition, a podcast series about the people who have taken matters into their own hands and started to build sustainable life forms in different parts of the world. Thank you for taking the time to listen.